This podcast is brought to you by the School of Security Studies at King's College London. Welcome to the War Studies podcast. My name is Sam Martin. The TV series Chernobyl has brought nuclear power back to the public's attention at precisely the same time as concern about climate change is at record levels. Many see nuclear power as key to curbing carbon emissions and preventing climate change. But do we have to accept the side effects and risks of nuclear in order to get to a carbon-free future? Or do the nuclear maths simply not stack up in the first place? Or are the risks themselves overstated? This week, King's College London brought academics and industry figures together to discuss nuclear energy and climate security. And later on, you'll hear a representative from the World Nuclear Association make the case for nuclear energy. But first, I spoke to Simon Chin Yee, a researcher at King's, to discuss his work on the global human impacts of climate change and the prospects for action. He started by explaining what he means by climate security.
Sure. So climate security actually can mean different things to different people. In general, in today's world, especially with the movements that have been taking place over the past year, it's about tackling the climate crisis, the recognition that there is a climate crisis and that we need to do something about it. At the government level, at the grassroots level. Now, in terms of users, the European Center for Energy and Resource Security, they look at it from an energy security point of view a lot of the time. So this can work in both developed and developing countries, making sure that there is energy, of course, in many developing countries. People do not have access to energy 100% of the time, sometimes not even 50% of the time, so there's that. Another way of looking at it is as issues of national security. So the US, the UK, the EU all have for the past 15 years included climate change in their security strategies. So this could be looking at border, cross-border migration, for example, or it could be looking at the exacerbation of conflicts in already volatile countries, for example, South Africa and Indonesia, and if the US will be having to intervene, for example, in these countries, they need a strategy, and they've had this in place since the mid-2000s. For myself, I look at it very much more as with the human dimension of security. Though this can mean everything from poverty, looking at the poor are always adversely affected by climate change, whether it's because of their crops failing, livestock dying, not having access to certain services. It's also a very gendered issue. Women and girls are also very adversely affected. Another issue with human security and climate change are health risks. And that's something that's maybe forgotten some of the time, is that the proliferation of diseases like cholera and malaria are back. I'll give you an example of Hurricane Idai in Mozambique just 2 months ago. When that, over 1,000 people died, first of all, in the initial crash of that hurricane. But what was very pressing for a lot of the people on the ground, both government officials and, of course, the aid workers that were in there working, was that all of the water was then overspilling and some of the towns were actually destroyed. So this meant that the water that they were using, a lot of the water using, was being contaminated, and they were very afraid of a cholera outbreak, for example. Another example is malaria. In Nairobi in Kenya, you never used to have malaria. It was higher up, it was colder, the malaria, mosquitoes. You had mosquitoes, but the malaria was kept down into the hotter regions. Now it's there, and it's been there for the past decade. Now it's a regular thing that people can get malaria. Finally, you're looking at entire populations moving. So this can be cross-border migration into neighboring countries, for example. It can be internal, in sub-Saharan Africa, there's a huge issue between herders having to move their cattle or their livestock to different areas, and they're coming into conflict with farmers. That's another security risk. Coastal erosion and sea level rise. If you're looking at small island developing states in particular, particularly in the Pacific Islands, like Kiribati or Tuvalu, they're in danger of potentially losing their land altogether. And finally, it's the proliferation of extreme weather events, such as Hurricane Idai, such as Hurricane Maria in Puerto Rico, that create large security issues with regards to climate change.
So how do we then get to climate security? And what are the options?
What we need to do is stop the talking and start the action. in the latest intergovernmental panel on climate change report that was put out last October, it is relatively optimistic in the fact that it's saying that we have the tools to do it and we have the know-how to do it. And in fact, we're in an incredible time in human history where we know exactly what we need to do and we actually know how to do it. We all need to play our part, but it's actually for governments to do, to put in the action. So we need the political will to take action. The second is, how do we get there? So you need two things. We need adaptation measures and we need mitigation measures. They need equal attention. A lot of developing countries have been shouting from the roof at these climate negotiations within the UN to give equal footing to both. This is because they are already in the situation and they have been for the past decade. They need to adapt to the situation at hand. So in terms of adaptation, that can be agriculture, to using different types of crops that are better suited now to the new environment they live in. It's about lifestyle choices for us. It's about perhaps eating less meat. It's about having one car, you know. These are certain choices that we need. And another adaptation is we need to put in place measures that protect areas that are damaged. It is happening. It's happening faster than we think, but this requires strategies, it requires planning, and it requires finance. In terms of mitigation, we need to be moving away from the more carbon-intensive energy sources like petroleum, like coal, like oil that we have been used to using and we've been habituated to use. We need to move to renewables, we need to move to solar, we need to move to wind. Finally, how do we get to climate security? Well, most of the people living on this planet are living in developing countries. The notion of climate justice needs to be addressed. In the UN, this notion of common but differentiated responsibility has been there for a couple of decades, since the early 2000s anyway. This is incredibly important because it addresses the fact that the most vulnerable populations, on the planet are the ones that are, first of all, not responsible for the situation we are in, and second of all, the most affected. They also happen to be the people that are least able to adapt to the situation because of their circumstances. This is why you find in the UN that you have the people that are in imminent danger of losing their land or being repeatedly hit by cyclones or hurricanes. They're the ones that are most vocal on action. Tuvalu, the Philippines. Island states, they don't want to be climate refugees. You know, this very, very politicized notion, this notion of climate refugees. But it has to be addressed because we need to understand what's going to happen to the people of Kiribati if in a generation's time, their land is gone. Anete Tong, the former president of Kiribati, he has already bought land in Fiji. I know that in Timor-Leste, another island state, they've already pledged land to the people of Kiribati, but that's not their land. They don't want to move. So for them, for these people, in order to address the climate challenge, we need to put in the mitigation measures. It's mitigation, not migration, that is key for their survival.
Okay. And for the biggest emitters, is it possible to get to climate security by changing the energy mix alone, or is it going to require reductions to consumption?
I think it'll be a combination of everything. We need to do all of these things in concert. We need the petroleum industries to recognize, and they're beginning to recognize, that action needs to be taken, and they need to change their way of operating. We as consumers need to recognize that we need to do more individually, even though it may feel that as an individual you're not able to contribute that much to the global effects of climate change. Climate change can be very depressing, and when you're thinking of this global catastrophe that a lot of people, they just don't want to recognize it's happening, or they recognize it's happening, but what are you as an individual going to do about it? It's true. We need, first and foremost, we need government movement. We need government protections. We need government will to do something. But in the end of the day, I think we all need to play our part.
So speaking to the event today, so what is the relationship between nuclear power and climate change?
So nuclear energy has been particularly controversial since 1945. Throughout its history, nuclear power has traversed the entire range of public and political opinion, from being kind of touted as a guarantor of energy security military security to facing widespread demonization, particularly following the Three Mile Island incident in the US, Chernobyl, of course, Fukushima in 2011. So there is a misconception around nuclear power as an energy source. However, there needs to be, we need to understand perhaps better how the nuclear industry fits in with climate change. So the nuclear energy industry would have us believe that nuclear needs to be part of the clean green solution to climate change. They have lobbied over the past couple of years to invest over $8 trillion in new building new nuclear plants by 2050. There has been a lot of resistance to this, to the plants because of the disasters that have happened. They say that it's only a matter of time. Within the decade, there'll be another one. There is an argument on the other side that nuclear energy is and needs to be part of any new energy solutions. In Asia, there are 35 plants under construction with another 70 or 80 planned. So there are, and there are, I've heard some environmentalists increasingly state that they believe that in order to achieve a low carbon energy world, we need to include nuclear in the discussion. However, I would argue that these statements are ultimately misleading. I think that in particularly in light of the new technologies within solar and wind and different renewables, that nuclear power has lost its place in terms of the future of energy consumption. At the moment, the argument would be that we are not at the point where renewables will give us the energy security we need in 2020. Sure, fine. But isn't it better to invest the $8 trillion that the energy sector would have a spend on the on nuclear in renewables to achieve a truly carbon neutral planet? That is what we're hoping for.
Are you optimistic about action on climate change?
I'm more optimistic than I used to be, I think. It does give me hope that the thousands of scientists that work on the different IPCC reports, although are damning in their portrayal of what is happening in the world today, and that they're positive in the fact that action, if action is taken, it is possible for us to achieve the goals we've set out. It's incredibly encouraging with the school strikes and the different grassroots level movements that are taking place all over the world, that youth and different groups are getting involved in pushing the governments to do the climate crisis. When the UK government a month ago decided to recognize climate change as a crisis, that was a pivotal moment. In terms of action, I'm hoping that regardless of the fact that the current Trump administration would have the US pull out of any climate deal, regardless of the fact that it's all about politicking and that we are talking about it too much and action isn't actually taking place, what we're seeing is that within the US, for example, cities, industry, high tech, mayors, states are pledging to keep their commitments to the Paris Agreement, regardless of what's happening in the White House. So that's, in one hand, encouraging. On the other hand, they still have to do it. So it's all great and good for us to make all the pledges in the world and all the agreements in the world to keep climate change down to solve the climate crisis, excuse me. But in its action, that's needed next.
Next, hear Philippe Costez, senior advisor at the World Nuclear Association, argue that nuclear is a vital part of the answer to climate change.
Well, thank you. As you said, I must apologize first for Anita Rizzini. She couldn't make it. I have the pleasure to be here with you, and I'll try to do my best. In order to present myself, I have what I call an atypical profile, because I spent all of my career, almost all my career, in electricity generation, but with a very wide scope. I started in construction for nuclear civil undergrounds and reactor vessel design. And then I went to waste to energy and recycling. And then I was a general secretary to the holding within Electricité de France, which was in charge of developing renewables for the group. So there, I gained some experience in geothermy, solar, wind, and biomass as well, quite a few. And we developed quite significantly renewables within Electricité de France. Then I joined back the nuclear industry, and I was in charge of implementing the long-term strategy for uranium procurement, which we did, and I worked also a lot on reprocessed uranium. This is not the topic for today. And then 2 years ago, I joined One Nuclear Association, the World Nuclear Association, with this kind of expertise, which is not only nuclear, but also renewables, and essentially also in development. So I have a lot of focus on financing, economics, on all those kind of energy. Let me maybe first Let me maybe first introduce the World Nuclear Association for those who don't know it. We are the international organization that represents the global nuclear industry. Our mission is to promote a wider understanding of nuclear energy among key international influences, and we promote and we produce information, we develop industry positions, and we try to contribute to the energy debate. The main stakeholders we are dealing with for the time being are, for instance, United Nations, the European Commission for Europe. We are dealing with the World Energy Council, and so forth. All the documentation we're producing is mostly available to, freely available, so I would invite you to browse it and use it whenever you want. Pathways, I mean, the title of this conference has become a very fashionable word in the sector of energy nowadays. With the advent of the climate change concerns, the different COPs, and the IPCC, Intergovernmental Panel for Climate Change, which feeds those political governments gatherings, the world has really started to consider that it faces a major threat. As a World Nuclear Association, we try to contribute to those discussions in presenting the contribution of nuclear energy associated with the other low-carbon sources in responding to a world demand for more energy and for a cleaner energy. In that context, I will present, I mean, the global drivers for nuclear energy and the vision, harmony vision, we developed within the World Nuclear Association. Let me start by looking at nuclear energy achievements so far. Here you can see the global nuclear energy electricity generation since the beginning of civil nuclear power in the 70s. After the slowdown following Fukushima in 29, nuclear generation has systematically increased. This is a demonstration that, I mean, as you said before, some countries are keep going on nuclear. In addition, I would say that, I mean, and you can see from that, in 2019, we're going to see 5 reactors in the world which are going to be in their 50th year. It means that at first, those reactors were designed for 40 years, and more we can see long-term operation as a way of developing a very economic way of producing electricity. And according to when we're looking at the cost of producing electricity, long-term operation is the cheapest way, because I mean most of the asset is there, and even by investing the capex you need for the extension of the operation for 10 or 20 years, even by upgrading to the new required safety requirements, it is proven to be the most effective and cost-effective one. What is the growth, and where do we see it? The growth capacity has been the fastest in the last 25 years. Most of the growth, and you're fully aware of that, is taking place in China and India, where nuclear is directly avoiding the use of coal. But many countries are introducing it, nuclear, for the very first time. Bangladesh, Belarus, United Emirate Arabs, and Turkey. And some other countries are really considering also as an option. You mentioned, I mean, the diversity of consideration within Europe, but Poland just recently announced that they are looking forward to. So, and UK is definitively one of the key, I mean, key country deciding to move on nuclear. Here we show, because I think this is important for the trend, the net yearly increase in nuclear capacity connected to the grid. So you have the gigawatt per hour, gigawatt electric on the left, and the year. The blue are the advanced economies, or the developed countries, mostly OECD. The green are the emerging countries. And what we see is that the bulk of development, new capacity, is in the emerging countries. That trend is going to continue, because developing countries, even they're going to see their electricity demand grow, but there are two counter effects. One of them is more and more electricity usage, electric vehicle and so on, but also the impact of energy efficiency. And this is a very good thing. So it means that for developed countries, I mean, the growth in electricity demand in most scenarios is very light. But the growth for electricity demand in emerging countries is very high. You were talking of Asia. You could say the same thing with Africa, with a population which is going to be 10 times in some decades. What is at stake with the growing demand for a clean energy? Access to electricity and clean air are vital. Some 2.7 billion people are estimated to be still don't have any clean cooking facilities, and more than 1 billion are still living without electricity. And as per the World Health Organization, around the world, about 7 million people die prematurely every year because of air pollution, much of which is associated with energy use. You might be familiar with this graph. I mean, it has been widely used last year for COP24, and it's coming from the IPCC report. It is a commonly accepted fact, and I'm not going to judge that here, that carbon emissions have an impact in the global increase of temperature. If the world keeps business as usual to 1.9 billion people, with the same aspiration to technical and energy development as we enjoy in our advanced countries, then the world is going to catastrophe. The Conference of the Parties, COP21 in 2015, in Paris, was a turning point. Countries realized that situation and decided it was time for action. But the sum of the commitments, I mean, do not fit with the goals. We need to be there at 2 degrees or 1.5 degrees. And so far, all the commitments that have been made after COP21 are above. So there is something to be done. And this has been one of the key outputs of the COP24, to realize that something was to be done. So what should be done? For COP22 in Poland, The IPCC produced this report, which is fully available on the net, and it compiles many studies worldwide that looked at achieving the 2 degree or even the 1.5 degree scenario. Key conclusion, nuclear is absolutely needed to achieve the 2 and obviously the 1.5 scenario on time, because it is quicker and more proven than any other source. Among the 1989, because IPCC is not producing a scenario on its own, it just compiled many scenarios. So among the 89 scenarios the IPCC reviewed, nuclear has to increase by an average of 2.5 times by 2050 compared to 2010 level. So according to IPCC, in average, we should go from 400 gigawatt, which is the existing capacity, to 1400 gigawatt. But if you consider another scenario by IPCC, which I call the P3, because the first one of the disadvantage, or maybe wrong consideration, is that they really consider that the energy demand is not going to grow a lot because of energy efficiency, even in developed, in emerging countries. But if we took a more realistic scenario, the P3, they said that nuclear should go 5 times. So we should be at 2400 gigawatt. In front of that, or aside, we at the World Nuclear Association, we have developed a goal for the nuclear community. We developed the Harmony Vision, which has a goal to achieve 25% of electricity supply before 2050. Today, nuclear is 11% of the electricity supply. If we achieve those 25% of electricity by 2050, in the low scenario, 43,000 terawatt hour per year, it would mean 1,000 gigawatt in new capacity, 400 plus 1,000 gigawatt. And there is obviously the one would be over 60 or 70 years old, 150. So we should end up by 1,250 gigawatt by 2050 in order to achieve 25% of a low scenario demand. If we want to go to a bigger energy demand, the scope is much, much more higher. But we developed this Harmony Vision before the IPCC came online. And so far, what we're looking at this program, it means that how can the industry deliver such new capacity at an affordable cost and on time? What are the conditions for success? The Harmony program we're working on at the World Nuclear Association is looking at the framework to identify the barriers, cost, time, regulation, markets, in order to provide with proper approach to remove those barriers. So we are looking at a level playing field. We are looking at creating an harmonized regulatory process and to have an effective safety paradigm. I will just highlight a little bit all those. Just recently, a week ago, at CEM, Clean Energy Ministerial in Vancouver, IEA published a nuclear report. It was the first time in 18 years they've been publishing this report. And here I quote Fatih Birol, the head of the International Energy Agency, IEA. He said that there is a need for all carbon energy sources, including nuclear, should the world is really considering achieving the 2 or even 1.5 degrees pathways. One comment on this report, which is a very interesting report, it is focused only on developed countries. It doesn't look too much on emerging countries. Hopefully, it's going to be something they have to look at. So definitely for developed countries, it's targeting the fact that nuclear in developed countries has to be on cost, on time, which has not been the case in the past, and is looking also at higher demand and so on. And one of the key issues is claiming as well, and I'm referring to one of the first sentences I said it first, is that for Europe, because we are talking of Europe, long-term operation, meaning extending the existing reactor, is key if we want to keep a certain level of low carbon electricity in Europe. So going back to the Harmony program, a level playing field. We consider, we try to explain that all low carbon sources should be treated in the same way. When we consider the cost of each sources, usually we look at CapEx and OPEX over the life duration and derive a levelized cost of electricity, LCOE. You should be familiar with that. On that prospect, we fully know that renewable costs have declined significantly in the past. When I was in solar, I was buying, solar panel for €3 per watt credit, and now it's less than one or half of a euro. So significant decreases. And for most recent nuclear in Europe or in a developed country, in the US as well, the industry didn't prove to be on time and budget. But the positive thing is that the EPR, for instance, or the AP1000, which is a Framatome and the Westinghouse design, were on time and on budget in China, and the Korean design in United Arab Emirates. The most recent OECD NEA stands for the Nuclear Energy Agency within the OECD, shows important facts regarding the cost. First of all, on the LCOE approach, when they look at the theoretical case base, we would start from nothing. What would be the cheapest way of generating 100 gigawatt of electricity? They stand for, it should be a mix of nuclear and CCGT, combined gas turbine, because without CO2 price, those are the cheapest. And afterwards, they've been looking at what happened when we increase the share of renewable. I would call them the VRE, the variable renewable energy, or the intermittent, in compare with hydro, which is not intermittent and can be dispatchable. When NEA is in this theoretical case, increasing the share of VRE, it shows that the LCOE, global LCOE, is increasing because the assumption on the cost of renewable are not as low as it should be in order to beat the nuclear plus gas scenario. But more important, because you could always consider that, we're going to have so much cost reduction in the future that maybe they could compete. But more important, they demonstrate the system cost. What are the system costs? Those are hidden costs, which are not part of the LCOE. They look for the grid reinforcement. Usually, when you implement a wind farm, you need to develop the grid because they are not fully located where the consumption is. You need backups, and you face, when you have a high share, a lot of curtailment. Just one figure, the big wind farms north of China, they suffered a 46% curtailment last year. With increasing share of VRE, those system costs increase a lot and may double the overall cost of electricity. When we refer to level playing field, we want to make sure that those costs are fully identified when policy decisions are made, and we should identify market regulation in order to recognize them. And this is where we're looking at a proper level playing field, treating all energy at the same level. What do we mean with a harmonized regulatory process? This is maybe more obvious. When considering, for instance, the case of the EPR in UK, Hinkley Point C, more than £2 billion have been spent on the licensing process for a design that have been fully assessed in a European country, in two European countries, by the way, in France and Finland. It is more than 10% of the total cost for the two reactors. Working with regulators, national and also with IAEA, would be a way to cut those costs and time without abandoning any safety concern. The last one, effective safety paradigm. Who knows that nuclear has the lowest accident fatalities record among other electricity sources? United Nations reported in their last year report and scare that Chernobyl accident is accounting today counting all the immediate deaths or the deaths that have been attributed to the exposition since the accident in 84, 85. The total number is less than 200 lives and zero from radioactivity at Fukushima. United Nations is very cautious in attributing any health effects for low dose exposition because in most of the case, after accident, the exposition to public was in the level of the average background levels of radiation. Another thing also we want to look at in the effective safety paradigm is nuclear has a very limited footprint in comparison to any other electricity sources. Life cycle analysis, which are developing, are an interesting tool to show that for climate change impact, nuclear and renewables do far better by an order of magnitude than coal and gas, even when there is carbon capture and storage in gas and coal. So what is the effective safety paradigm we're working on? Is to create an effective safety paradigm focusing on public well-being, where the health, environmental, and safety benefits of nuclear are better understood and valued when compared to any other energy sources. Two other comments, hopefully I'm not too long. Can the industry deliver the program IPCC is aiming for? Here are the latest, on the left side, latest construction rate. In the 84, we were at 30 gigawatt per year. In the recent year, we were at 5, and it doubled or even tripled in 2019, 5 to 10 gigawatt per year, and we should achieve 15 in 2019. To achieve the harmony goal, if we want to achieve the 1,000 gigawatt I was referring to up front, it means that much new project should be launched. Taking into consideration 10 gigawatt up to 2020, we will need to go to 25 or 30 gigawatt in the next decades. The industry in the past, US, France, Sweden, they showed in the 80s that it was able to cope with that rate, the 30 gigawatt we had in 84, for instance, of new build, and totally decarbonize their electricity system at that time. Not only mastering the cost and time are key for the future nuclear new build, but innovation also had to play a key role. I mentioned here small modular reactors, when proven and affordable, because they are just at the beginning. We expect to have a first one new scale by 2025. So when they are proven and affordable, they could provide remote communities with energy. And in some case, and Finland is considering it, they could supply heat for district heating. Advanced reactors, high temperature gas reactor for industrial heat, with higher operating temperature could provide those industrial processes that require high temperature, which is either steel, chemicals, being a solution and displace fossil fuel. Electric vehicle, potentially hydrogen transport, will create additional need for clean electricity. And fast reactor in the, I would say, long term, I mean, will provide for extended fuel utilization. Well, and I think I'm almost at the end of it. I really think that a key issue in 2018 was the IPCC report that fully demonstrated, I mean, the urge of considering nuclear as a solution to achieve this 1.5 or 2 degree scenario. And I really think that this is a responsibility for the industry to make sure that we can deliver that. I mean, this is the answer we have to give for the future, I mean, future generation. Thank you. I just added in addition, I mean, all our websites. I mean, this is where you can find a lot of information, proven information, free information. So please look at it. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this edition of the War Studies podcast. For more information about the School of Security Studies, visit kcl.ac.uk/securitystudies.